Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the number of new COVID-19 cases has been declining in Wisconsin, and people 65 and older are now eligible for vaccines. We'll talk to a doctor about what's happening and what to keep in mind after getting a shot. First, it's the week in Washington. This is the first Wednesday of 2021 not marked by an I word, insurrection, impeachment, or inauguration. But we're seeing the consequences of all three of those playing out in the Capitol. Senators were sworn in yesterday as impeachment jurors. The Senate trial is now scheduled for the former president, despite a failed Republican motion calling it unconstitutional. There's also been a lot of talk around the filibuster and whether it should stay or go. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about how Congress has sorted out its priorities in this unusual month? Do you think this impeachment trial of former President Trump should move forward, or should senators let it go? Call in. Oh, and what do you think about the filibuster? Should that stay or go? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer Habercorn covers Congress for the LA Times. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, yeah, looking at Wednesdays this year, the 6th, we had the Electoral College vote count and the raid on Congress. The next week, Wednesday, the 13th, we had the impeachment vote in the House coming in as we were on the air. Last week, the inauguration had just wrapped up. Does this kind of feel like more of a normal day, Jennifer, than our last few Wednesdays?
Well, I don't want to jinx it, but now, yes, it certainly seems a little more normal, although there's a lot going on in Washington. So it feels a little busier for normal, even for 2021.
Well, and let's start with one of those things making things busier, the impeachment. The House had voted to impeach the president. Now it's in the Senate's hands for a trial. We had this vote led by some Republican senators to say, hey, we can't do a trial. He's out of office. It's unconstitutional. What ended up going down there?
So we had 45 senators support the position that the trial is unconstitutional. And that's noteworthy because there's only 50 Senate Republicans, and 45 of them indicated this was just a procedural vote, but they backed the argument essentially that a Senate trial right now is unconstitutional because former President Trump is now a private citizen. Some of those Republicans left open the possibility that they're going to listen to arguments and could potentially vote to convict. But it's going to be very hard for those 45 Senate Republicans to say, on January 26th, I indicated that I thought this was unconstitutional, and now I'm going to vote to convict. So what those Republicans wanted to do was to send the message that you're never going to get 67 senators, including 17 Republicans, to vote to convict, that impeachment is essentially dead on arrival in the Senate.
That said, it looks like we're going to have some kind of trial. What do we know about when and how?
Yes, there will be a trial. Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer has said that the trial is going to happen. It's going to start no sooner than February 9th. We're kind of in a pause in the trial right now because both sides will have time to write some briefs. When it starts on the 9th or perhaps the 10th, it could be very short. They haven't determined yet how many days the trial is going to be, but there's some of my sources are saying that it could be as few as 3 days. And right now, with the fate of conviction pretty much certain, there's some speculation that both sides kind of want this to be over and done with quickly. Republicans, for obvious reasons, they don't want even more time for a case to build. But Democrats, too, are much more interested now in confirming Joe Biden's cabinet appointments. They want to work on legislation. So they may also be incentivized to do this trial relatively quickly.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Madison. Chris, hi. Are you there, Chris? I feel like we hear Chris, and Chris is not hearing us. Let's see. Summing up, it looks like Chris wants impeachment to go forward, saying the riot was the worst of the president's actions, and Chris says President Trump was responsible and there needs to be accountability. We're 3 weeks out, Jennifer, from, you know, the Capitol, where all these senators are and members of the House were and the vice president was being stormed. are people still talking about, even if they're saying Republican senators saying don't impeach the president, are they still talking about that event and whether the president should be held accountable in some way?
Yes, they're definitely still talking about it. I mean, the physical scars on the Capitol are still in place. There's a door that a lot of lawmakers and reporters like myself walk past every day that still is broken, still is shattered, is sitting in the window pane. So the scars are still there. I mean, keep in mind that this is lawmakers' workplace. Their workplace was stormed. So there's a lot of folks who, you know, were terrified that day and still feel that. So it is interesting to see there's some physical response still to the events of January 6th. But politically, Republicans in particular seem to want to move on. There's not even discussion at this point of a censure. There's a couple members talking about doing some kind of censure, but it really has not picked up any steam. I mean, the Republicans that I was speaking to yesterday were saying, you know, Trump will have gone through two impeachment trials. That should be it. It's really interesting that they're still talking about how their staff members.
Looks like we've got Jennifer Habercorn muted right now. We're talking to Jennifer Habercorn from LA Times, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on impeachment, the filibuster, and more. Jennifer, do we have you back?
Yes.
Okay, sorry, we lost you for a second there.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. So you're talking about, staff members in Congress and how they went through the event, I think, is where we lost you.
Yeah, so it's interesting to me that a lot of these lawmakers, their staff, you know, went through the events of January 6th. They themselves went through the events, and yet politically, they really want to move on.
Let's move on ourselves to the filibuster now and setting new rules for this 50-50 Senate, with Democrats having the vice presidential tiebreaker, negotiations between new Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Minority Leader now Mitch McConnell, including McConnell dropping apparently a demand that Democrats promise to not remove the filibuster. Here is Schumer, first of all, speaking on the Senate floor.
I am glad the Republican leader finally relented, and we can move forward now to organize the Senate, set up committees, chairs, and ranking members, and a process for moving bills and nominees to the floor from committees with an evenly divided number of members. I'm glad we're finally able to get the Senate up and running. My only regret is that it took so long.
And now here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
The bar for lawmaking is high. It should be high, even if both bodies take turns being slightly frustrated by it. If your legislation can't pass the Senate, you don't scrap the rules or lower the standards. You improve your idea, you take your case to the people, or both.
So, Jennifer, can you sum up the argument over the filibuster and how it was getting in the way of getting things done?
Yeah, the filibuster, I think, is going to be one of the really interesting debates of this year in the Senate among Democrats. Democrats are under a lot of pressure from progressives to do away with the filibuster, which is the requirement essentially that most legislation needs 60 votes to pass. Without it, legislation would only require 50 votes to pass, and Democrats have 50 votes. But there's moderate Democrats who are really skeptical about doing away with this, because the Senate is supposed to be an institution that operates with a lot of protections for the minority party. And as McConnell made the point, and some Democrats agree, that legislation should be kind of difficult to pass because it's more sustainable when you have some members of both parties on board. But, you know, the reality is going to be that the Senate is very partisan right now. And if President Joe Biden wants to get any legislation done, he's going to have to get 10 Republican votes, which is a seemingly insurmountable bar he's going to have to reach. So as Biden puts forward more legislation, as Democrats put forward more legislation, if Republicans obstruct those bills, they're going to face more and more pressure to undo this filibuster so that some of Biden's initiatives can become law.
We're talking to Jennifer Habercorn, congressional reporter for the LA Times. It's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you want to see Democrats in the Senate get rid of the filibuster to give a shot at getting some of the new president's policies into place? Do you want to see cooperation from Republicans and Democrats? What do you think they could cooperate on? How about a new COVID-19 economic relief? One of the big issues they'll be tackling. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jennifer Habercorn from the LA Times, looking at some of the top stories in national politics, including the latest in the Senate on impeachment, the filibuster, policy, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on those topics. But we'll go back to your calls now. Marion is with us in Minnesota. Marion, hi.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yep. Go for it, Marianne.
Okay. I am disgusted with the way the Republican Party is acting. They are giving the message that if you're powerful, you don't have to face the law, that you're above the law. And that's the message they're giving. Any ordinary citizen who would have done what Trump did, they would be in jail right now. In fact, there are people in jail who stormed the Capitol or who planned it. And he is not being held accountable. The Republicans are giving him another pass on his bad behavior.
Marion, thanks a lot for the call. Jennifer, that's the argument we're hearing from some Democrats in the House and Senate on this. Have people been debating so far pre-trial the merits of the argument of incitement to insurrection? That's the main part of this article of impeachment.
Unfortunately, no. Most of the debate is really on whether the trial is even constitutional. There's Republicans who argue that the trial, because President Trump is now a former president and a private citizen, they say that the trial cannot move forward. Democrats and many legal scholars disagree with that, and they point to the fact that the Senate has, one time at least, held an impeachment trial for a former official after he left office. Also, the Constitution says that a trial can be held for two points. One is the merits of the case, and one is a vote on whether to bar that official from public office in the future. And so they point to that as evidence that the impeachment trial is not just to punish. It could be for future, to prevent a person from coming back into public office. So that's what the debate has really been on. It has not really been on the merits. I mean, a lot of these lawmakers were witnesses to the riot. They've seen the clips of President Trump on television. And even many Republicans say that Trump bears some responsibility for stirring up the crowd that later stormed the Capitol.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Ziggy now in Richfield. Ziggy, hi.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the filibuster. It's well known that Congress has a hard enough time getting things done, and having to have anything besides a majority vote just seems to impede that progress.
Ziggy, thanks a lot for calling. That's been one of the arguments against the filibuster, Jennifer. But there is always the fear that if we get rid of it while we're in charge, whichever party is the we in this scenario, it's going to still be gone when the other party takes over at some point.
Absolutely. And I think one of the repercussions of getting rid of the filibuster is that you would see legislation really swing back and forth depending on whether one party controls Washington. Take, for instance, the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, that was very controversial. Republicans, when they came into office after passage of that law, said that they wanted to repeal it. They came close to repealing it a couple years ago. They did not have the votes. Even without the filibuster, they would not have had the votes, but it would have made it a lot easier. You look at something like abortion. Republicans in the Senate have voted to ban abortion at 20 weeks. They would have had the votes to do it if not for the filibuster. So I think you'd see a lot of major legislation flip back and forth very rapidly if one party controls the White House, the Senate, and the House.
Thanks a lot for that call. Patrick joins us next in Stoughton. Patrick, hello.
Hello. I'm remembering a couple of years ago when the Republicans wanted to jam through a bunch of court nominations, including the Supreme Court nominations, that they got rid of the 60-vote rule for judges. So, you know, I'm finding Mitch McConnell to kind of be a hypocrite in that, you know, they took it away when it from nominating judges. And judges, you know, are a lifetime appointment. Legislation gets changed over time and modified. So I don't, you know, the Republicans are masterful politicians when it comes to doing this kind of stuff. When
Patrick, they're in- thanks a lot for the call, Patrick. Jennifer, correct me if I'm wrong. I think this has been kind of a spiraling escalation. Democrats got rid of the filibuster for some court appointments. The Republicans in charge got rid of it for Supreme Court. So it's been a little back and forth leading up to where we are. Is that right?
Yes, you and the caller are right. We have seen the filibuster really be degraded in the last several years. The difference here is that this is on legislation. Some people draw a distinction between nominations, which is what the filibuster has been eliminated for so far, and legislation. Of course, proponents of getting rid of the filibuster now see little distinction there, but it definitely has been degraded in recent years. Yes.
Thanks a lot for that call. We are talking to Jennifer Habercorn from the LA Times, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Well, let's turn to some policy items that might put this stuff to the test, Jennifer. And one of these is the idea of more COVID-related economic relief, funding for vaccines and so forth coming from the Biden administration. Democrats are looking at maybe if they can't get Republican support, trying another tactic to get that passed without having to get rid of the filibuster. What's going on?
You're right. This is going to be the immediate test of how much appetite Democrats have for bipartisanship and getting rid of the filibuster. So Biden has proposed this large, ambitious COVID relief bill that Republicans are already refusing because they say it's too much money. It's nearly $2 trillion. So Democrats are considering, as soon as next week, moving forward with a special Senate procedure. I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but essentially the Senate has up to two opportunities every year to pass legislation without the filibuster. And they're going to try to use that procedure on this big COVID bill. It's a somewhat complicated process, but essentially means if it's related to the budget, you can pass it with only 50 votes. So they're saying all of this COVID relief is related to the budget. We're going to pass it with 50 votes. Republicans, meanwhile, say, hey, you're, you know, starting the Biden administration by immediately using this special procedure and not even trying to negotiate with us. And they kind of have some merit to that case, that Democrats are trying to say that they're negotiating, but they're really not. They're just moving forward with this process right away. So that may get underway as soon as next week. And it's likely to pass. Democrats are likely to have the votes to move forward with this, but it could risk setting the tone of, you know, more partisanship that we've seen in the last several years.
And part of this is the idea of sending another round of checks. Effectively, people have been talking about $2,000. Democrats in the House did. Some Republicans in the Senate did. President Trump said $2,000. So Biden's saying, hey, $1,400. We'll round that $600 up to $2,000. Given that there was some, you know, there were a couple senators, Republican senators, I think Josh Hawley among them, who were supportive of that $2,000 idea. Is that something that people are thinking might fly?
There is support for checks. I think you're going to lose Republicans on some of the other issues, including the significant price tag. I don't think it'll end up staying at this $1.9 trillion neighborhood. It might come down a bit, but Republicans so far are very skeptical of many parts of this bill, except for checks in some cases, as well as money for vaccines. That really seems to be the point of potential bipartisanship, just throwing a ton of money at beefing up vaccine production and supply.
Let's go back to our callers. Tom is with us now in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if Jennifer knew of any other states besides Wisconsin where we have a governor, for instance, who's trying to institute common sense COVID responses like masks and social distancing and gathering limits, but we have a Republican legislature that's trying to overturn that.
Tom, thanks for the call. I think this would make, as if this happens, the 10th state without a mask mandate. I'll stick to your area, Jennifer, in federal politics. We've heard some from President Biden on mask mandates, but his powers are limited. He says, yes, you got to wear a mask on federal property. What other kinds of things are we hearing when it comes to anti-COVID efforts?
There's not much talk of any kind of federal mask mandate. I should say that in the Capitol, many lawmakers wear masks. There's some House Republicans who've really resisted that, as well as Senator Rand Paul on the Senate side, but there's widespread mask use. But there is a lot of support for vaccines and ramping up the vaccine supply. And if President Biden is looking for an area where he can find some common ground, that's probably going to be it, because there's very few lawmakers who are against that right now. In fact, many lawmakers got their own early access to the vaccines as part of continuity of government operations. So there is a lot of support for vaccines and distribution on Capitol Hill.
We'll be talking more about COVID-19 coming up after the news. Jennifer, in our last few moments, apart from this big stuff we've been talking about, what else do you have your eye on in the coming week?
Oh, well, between COVID relief and impeachment, those are the biggest things, and they feel quite large. The Senate also needs to just kind of get functioning. We ran into this really interesting problem as part of the filibuster debate, that the Senate couldn't start operating until it made an agreement on what it was going to do on the filibuster. And so it led to a really slow start for President Biden's cabinet nominees. He is at a historically low number of cabinet appointments who've been confirmed, and there's bipartisan concern about that. Of course, Republicans aren't crazy about Biden's Democratic appointees to the cabinet, but the DHS secretary has not been confirmed. That's a really vital national security position. And I think in the coming weeks, we're going to see more opposition from Republicans to some of those cabinet appointments.
Jennifer, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Habercorn covers Congress at the LA Times. She joined us for this week's look at the top stories in national politics, including impeachment, the filibuster, and more. Coming up after the news, we'll check in with a doctor about Wisconsin's COVID-19 numbers and what we should know as more people start to get vaccinated. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, find out why fewer Wisconsin high school seniors are signing up for college financial aid, and hear the case for the state's technical college system as a solid option for a lot of students, young and old. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsin started vaccinating people 65 and older against COVID-19 on Monday, a process that's expected to take at least several weeks. The state health department says that the next vaccination phase, which will tentatively start around March 1st, will cover teachers, food service workers, bus drivers, and other essential workers. Tomorrow, the Wisconsin Assembly is planning to vote on a resolution that would strike down the statewide mask mandate. And this all comes at a time when the 7-day average of new COVID cases in the state has dropped to its lowest point since September. There's a lot going on. A public health expert joins us now to take stock of what's happening. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about COVID-19 or about the vaccines we have? You're wondering what will or won't be safe as we move through the vaccination process. Are you wearing a mask when you go out or in with other people? Are you double masking? Are you upgrading your mask game? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Jeff Potthoff is the Chief Quality Officer for UW Health. Dr. Potthoff, welcome back to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
Well, as you look at the statewide trends in numbers going down, still high compared to last summer, but a lot lower compared to November, what are your thoughts on where we are right now?
Yeah, I mean, our trend lines have been good. We've seen, you know, a decreased number of cases. We've seen, you know, decreased hospitalizations. This is all very good news. I think the one thing that worries us about these trends is, like you said, it doesn't mean that COVID is gone. It doesn't mean that we're over with this pandemic. It just means we're headed in the right direction. But I think when we hear these trends, we start to get a little bit itchy to get back to normal. And right now, that could spell trouble for us. We're not doing so well that we can just turn the switch and get back to normal.
Yeah, and I don't want to be good news, bad news guy here, but the bad news is there are these variants of the virus that causes COVID-19 that seem to be more transmissible. Do you worry about those waiting in the wings?
So we do. I mean, right now there's this epic battle setting up between the vaccines and the variants. These variants are much more infectious. So even small gaps in your mitigation strategies, wearing a mask, socially distancing, you might have got away with it a little bit before with the older version of coronavirus. You're less likely to get away with it with these new versions. And if they start to spread, they'll start spreading fast. On the flip side, in the other corner, are the vaccines. The vaccines look to still be effective against these variants. So if we have fast and broad rollout of the vaccine, it makes the variants a little bit less to worry about. But, you know, right now, I think it's anybody's guess which one's going to win.
Now, the vaccine rollout at the national level, people have said, kind of bumpy. In Wisconsin, we're behind the national average in the lower fifth of states, it looks like, on some of the ways they measure it. What are your thoughts on how the vaccine rollout has been going so far?
Yeah, I don't think anyone's completely happy with how it's gone so far. We need to be injecting, you know, more people more quickly. You know, earlier on during the process, we were kind of under the impression that the federal government had a lot of doses ready to go. And the bottleneck was really in the vaccinators, you know, getting the vaccines, getting them injected into people. You know, we got through 1A. Now we're looking at 1B. It's a huge group of people. A lot of these healthcare systems and other, you know, public health departments are really gearing up to do a lot of vaccinations. And then we kind of heard maybe we don't have as many doses. That got us worried. But now we are hearing from the federal government that they are going to invest more funds, more effort into getting those doses to us. So I'm hopeful at this point that that all comes together and we can see a pretty big acceleration in vaccinations, especially as we're looking at, you know, 700,000 people in the state over the age of 65 that we need to get vaccinated in the next 3-4 weeks.
Can you talk a little about the logistical challenges of vaccination? Because there's the doses of the vaccine, obviously a key element. There's also the people to give those vaccines and the equipment to give the vaccines. What all goes into successfully delivering that vaccine?
Yeah, I mean, it is so complicated. I think, you know, at the simplest form, people are saying, you know what, like it's a syringe with liquid that you stick in someone's arm and push the plunger. How hard can this be? But, you know, it starts from the distribution. Like you want to make sure you give it to the people who need it the most. But at the same time, don't make that such a selective group that you're having a tough time filling your schedule. You need to take care of the vaccine. So the ones that we have right now, particularly the Pfizer vaccine, pretty tight storage requirements as far as ultra cold refrigeration. You have to have security to make sure that it's not tampered with or not stolen. And then you can imagine the tracking that needs to happen. So I need to know that you got your first dose. Once you got your first dose, I have to have a process to ensure you get your second dose. And I have to make sure that when you get your dose, I record that, because there's a good chance that in the near future, you're going to have to show proof of vaccination to do the things you want to do. And if we don't provide that for you, that's not going to work out well either. And then there's just, you know, how do you schedule 700,000 people into a scheduling system, have it work out really well? There's going to be cancellations and you can't waste any doses at the end of the day. So then you have to have a process that lets you find people who are available on very short notice, who can get that handful of doses at the end of the day that are left over. So incredibly complex. I know on our side, we've had teams working on this for months already, and it's still just a lot of work.
We're talking to Dr. Jeff Potthoff, Chief Quality Officer for UW Health, looking at the latest COVID news. As always, there's lots of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and maybe your questions about the COVID-19 rates, the vaccine rollout, the new variants of COVID-19, masks, you name it, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Potthoff, let's talk about, you know, there are people out there listening who've probably had their vaccination, their first round anyway. Some will be getting it. When somebody gets that first shot on their arm, should they go right from that appointment to the crowded, you know, dance hall? Or are we still kind of being careful soon after that?
So we are still being very careful. And the reason being is that that first shot doesn't offer you a lot of protection, doesn't really generate a lot of immunity. And we track healthcare workers who get the first dose, and there are a number of them that then end up contracting COVID-19. So, you know, don't change anything after that first dose. After that second dose, 7 to 10 days afterwards is when they started measuring people's antibodies levels, the immune response. That's where you start seeing those high efficacy numbers, 95% effective in you getting symptoms of the disease, close to 100% effective in preventing you from getting severe COVID-19.
Let's talk masks now. We've been, a lot of us, myself included, have been wearing the cloth masks that are, say, mother-in-law made, something like that. And I think the word on the street is they're still better than nothing. But it seems like I'm seeing more and more recommendations saying, yeah, more of us should have moved to, you know, N95 or fancier masks by now. Or I've heard talk about doubling up on the cloth masks. Do we need to up our mask game even if we have been wearing one?
You know, I'm not so sure that we do. I think, you know, for the most part, we want a mask on someone's face. And, you know, a two-layer can't see through cloth mask is pretty good. It may not be quite as good as a paper surgical mask, but it might be more readily available. It certainly will be cheaper because you can wash it. So I don't think that that's a problem. You know, we are hearing some people say, you know, sometimes when I go into maybe a high-risk environment, I double mask. And that's not necessarily harmful. But what we have seen are that masks are pretty effective. So it's probably more about making sure that you're wearing a mask, you know, all the time. You're not having gaps in wearing your mask. You're not taking it off when you're in a high risk situation than trying to put, you know, two on. So I think you'll hear different recommendations from different folks. But from what we've seen, if you can effectively and consistently wear a facial covering, you're going to be able to protect yourself almost all of the time from getting sick from this disease. You offer yourself a lot of protection. It's not 100%, but it's pretty good.
I mentioned earlier that the state legislature, half of it has voted to try to overturn the state's mask mandate. Other half expected to vote on that tomorrow. We're going to talk about that tomorrow and the politics behind it. I'm guessing your message is, regardless of mandate, you're hoping people are going to wear that mask in public.
Yeah, I mean, we really need to hold the line here. We're so close. Right now seems like not the time to reverse the guidance on wearing masks or the mask mandate. I know that, you know, they're you know, really debating, you know, who has the authority to give the mask mandate. And I think, you know, those of us in medicine, we don't much care whether it's the governor or the legislature. We just need a mask mandate in place. So whether that's revoking the governor's mask mandate, I think then we'd want to see the legislature put their own mask mandate on so that the minute the governor's is revoked, we have something from the legislature that protects the people.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Aislinn is with us in Madison. Aislinn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, I was just wondering, is there a reason why all of these decisions are being made now in terms of like the rollout, for instance? Why has it taken till now to decide who gets what? Like, why wouldn't this have been thought about, processed, and like ready to go when we had a vaccine? I feel like everybody's just like pretend it didn't happen and then wait. You know, so I was just wondering, was there a reason why they waited, or have they been working on it the whole time, but they're only talking about it now?
Aislinn, thanks for the call. So the planning for the rollout of vaccines, Dr. Potthoff, and the priority list.
Yeah, so for sure the planning has been going on for a while, you know, much earlier than when the vaccines actually became available on the vaccinator side of things. I think the thing that got us a little bit tripped up is we didn't necessarily know how many doses were going to be out there. Without knowing the doses, it's hard for those state agencies who wanted an opportunity to customize their rollout for their state to really pick, you know, what is 1A, what is 1B. And it kind of pushed things forward to the point where it does seem like, you know, we got a little bit behind, like we could have done a little bit more up ahead. But that isn't how it rolled out. Now, I think like that's getting better now with some of the more recent information that we're getting out of the federal government, you know, guarantees on, you know, how many doses that we're going to get. That makes it a lot easier for these groups to plan for what they're going to be able to do. But I think the caller had a point. For the first couple of weeks, it seemed like it was more touch and go than what it should have been for something that we knew was coming.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Jeff Potthoff, Chief Quality Officer at UW Health. We're talking to him about COVID-19 numbers and what to keep in mind as more people get vaccinated. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about COVID-19, the latest news, the vaccines? What do you want to see happen with that mask mandate here in the state? Are you seeing people wearing masks when you go out and about in your community? Do you go out and about much in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Dr. Jeff Potthoff, Chief Quality Officer at UW Health, looking at the latest COVID-19 developments in the state and where we're headed with vaccinations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your comments and your questions. Let's go back to your calls now. We've got Robert on the line in Madison. Robert, hi.
Hi. My question is, well, I've been thinking about it, but anyhow, we went from the UW testing, went from the swab, nasal swab, to the saliva test. You know, there's a lot of us thinking that, is this because of money? After being diligent for over a year, wearing a mask, here it is, all of a sudden now I'm being herded into Madison, well, into inner Madison and downtown, to sit there among a bunch of people and spit into a trash can and so forth. Who knows who's been sitting there before me? I guess I just would like to be reassured that this isn't just for the sake of money. Also,
Robert. I've got a lot of callers I want to get to, but thanks for calling in. So you talked particularly about UW's employee, I believe, and maybe students testing, Dr. Potthoff, but that saliva test versus the swab, is one cheaper? Is one more reliable?
Yeah, no, so they're about the same cost. There's a little bit less supply with those swabs there's more supply with the nasal swab, but really what they wanted to do was have something that was easier for people to do. For anyone who's gotten the nasal swab for the COVID test, it's not a real pleasant experience. Most people will even tear up. It's much easier to just give some spit and put it in a cup. And what we needed to know was that spit test was going to be as accurate as the nasal pharyngeal test. As research did testing, we found that it was. So that's why you're seeing a bit of a switch from the nasal pharyngeal test, that swab up your nose, to the spit. It's actually better for patients. It's more comfortable and gives us just as good results.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Janet now in Iron Ridge. Janet, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Something your guest said kind of scares me a little bit about tracking with the vaccine. He said something to the effect of we need to track the people who have the vaccine so they are allowed to go and do what they would like to do versus people who don't get the vaccine, who choose not to get it. Is this something I should be worried about?
Janet, thanks for the call. The only time I remember you mentioning tracking, Dr. Potthoff, was to make sure the people who got their first dose got their second dose too, unless I missed something.
Yeah, so there's that. So certainly if you get your first dose, we have to make sure that we can track that you get your second dose. The other thing, and this happens with all vaccines, is there's a statewide database that, you know, doctors use to figure out, you know, are you up to date on your tetanus or did you get this or that vaccine? It helps us make good medical decisions. Now, we haven't seen vaccine requirements for certain activities, whether it be travel or other things, but we certainly have seen, you know, airlines requiring tests or country requiring negative tests. And what we don't want to do is vaccinate people, have them meet that criteria that other organizations or countries are setting up for us, and then not have proof so that they could use that. So we want to make sure that if you get vaccinated, we can provide you the proof that you might later need to do other things that you might want to do.
Thanks for that call, Janet, at 800-642-1234. Greg joins us next in Lake Geneva. Greg, hi.
Hi, how are you today? Thank you for taking my call. My question is a face mask effective enough in that using wearing that without a cloth or paper mask?
You're talking those shields, Greg? Those kind of clear plastic shields that I see football coaches wear, for example?
Sure, no. We purchase some that look like a pair of glasses and a shield is attached to the glasses. They're very comfortable, but do they do anything?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. And you'll see healthcare workers wear those face shields. We call them face shields. Unfortunately, it's not going to do a lot to protect you out in the community. We wear them in healthcare because we get really close to people's faces, and sometimes those droplets can come out and they can actually infect you through your eyes. So that's why we wear them. But most people, the vast majority of people who are going to get COVID-19 are going to get it through those droplets that are floating in the air. And the face shield won't protect you from that. A face mask, a cloth face mask, a paper face mask will. So we'd much rather you wear a face mask than a face shield. If you want to wear a face shield with a face mask, not a problem, but a face mask at a minimum.
Thanks for that call. And Dr. Potthoff, that scenario you said with a healthcare worker, if they're wearing that face shield, that's in addition to their mask, not instead of. Do I have that right?
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Joe joins us next in Milwaukee. Joe, hi.
Hi there. My comment is that in Japan, they have a population of 120 million people, and they've had a little north of 4,000 deaths. And the only thing that they do differently than us is that they wear masks at a very high rate. So if you subtract 12,000 from 425,000, which is where we're at now, you can put all the rest of those deaths on the Trump administration and apparently on the Wisconsin Republican Party, too. I just can't believe that they're incapable of going out and seeing the statistics worldwide where people wore masks and where they didn't.
Joe, thanks for the call. Dr. Potthoff, I'm going to guess you don't want to get into the partisan politics of that, but if we were really good consistently as a population at wearing masks, is it something that would have been saving lives all along?
Yeah, I mean, the data is really good now on the mask wearing. We have it from all over the world. It makes a tremendous difference. It decreases the spread of this disease. It decreases the number of people that get sick, and it'll decrease the number of people who die. So without getting into the partisan politics, the science, the data, the facts behind mask wearing are irrefutable. They save lives.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Dr. Jeff Potthoff, Chief Quality Officer at UW Health, looking at some of the latest news on COVID. Now, early on in this, you came on the show, Dr. Potthoff, and we talked some about, you know, protecting healthcare workers and their morale through the ups and downs of all of this. What are you seeing in your staff these days? What are you hearing from people?
You know, the vaccine was a real, you know, shot in the arm, pun intended, for our morale and healthcare. I mean, it's still hard and we still work long hours, but between having the vaccine available and kind of the confidence and peace of mind that gives you as a healthcare worker, knowing that you're probably not going to get really sick from this disease anymore. I mean, that was scaring us to death throughout the entire pandemic. Coupled with, you know, people in the state doing what they needed to do. We didn't see spikes after Thanksgiving. We didn't see spikes after Christmas or New Year's. Our volumes and the inpatient side are a bit down. That gives us a little bit of breather room. Morale is much better. It's a much better environment right now. Vaccines are on the horizon. There's going to be an end date to this pandemic. We're getting vaccinated. Our volumes aren't quite as high. There's just a lot going well right now.
And that takes us to a point you kind of started us off with maybe an end in sight or big improvements in sight with that vaccine. This is a bad time to let our guards down if we could just make it that little bit longer.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing that we worry about is, you know, here in Wisconsin, this isn't true in other parts of the country, but things have been looking better. I mean, volumes of patients are going down. Volumes of cases are going down. Vaccines are, you know, starting to speed up in their rollout. I just think it's human nature. It's really easy to start thinking that, you know, it's over. Like, let's celebrate. And it's just, you know, not quite yet. Let's not put the cart before the horse. We got a little bit of work to do yet. There's still a lot of COVID out in our communities. We're still seeing people. Our hospitals still have COVID patients in them. But I think it gets a little bit easier to, you know, keep your distance, to wear your mask when you know that there's going to be an end date to this. This is not going to be a forever thing. This is going to be something that's going to be past tense, hopefully in the next couple months.
Dr. Potthoff, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
You bet. Anytime.
Dr. Jeff Potthoff is the Chief Quality Officer at UW Health. He was with us to talk about what we're seeing with COVID-19 cases in Wisconsin and what we should keep in mind as more people become eligible for vaccination. We'll talk more about the topic tomorrow, specifically on the mask mandate here in the state. One chamber of the legislature has voted to overturn it. The other expected to vote tomorrow morning. We'll take a look at it, find out what's going on. And of course, you can weigh in on that. Also coming up tomorrow on Central Time, being devoted to our jobs doesn't always pay off in the long run. We'll talk to the author of the new book called Work Won't Love You Back. And musical instrument sales went up during the pandemic as people took the opportunity to get into music or back into music. We'll get some advice for musical first timers and second timers, and you could share your own story. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Yesterday on the show, we talked about grown-ups liking kid movies, and you called in to share some of your favorites. And we've heard from some more of you since then. Sandy from Rhinelander emails, the Shrek movies are some of my favorites. Alicia emails, I'm a teenager, but I personally like to watch shows like My Little Pony or Good Luck Charlie. And in my opinion, no adult should be ashamed to share what favorite kid shows they like to watch, even without their child around. Alicia says there had been some shame about admitting to liking kid shows, but goes on, listening to the radio yesterday gave me the confidence to not be scared. No show is a little kid show when it comes to something you love. Deborah wrote on the Ideas Network Facebook page, Moana, I loved hearing my grandson's laughter in the movie theater. Loved all the songs. I love the vibrant colors of the Polynesian world. Loved the humor of the demigod Maui. I love the adventurous heroine who took action on her own and didn't need a prince to come and save her. Just, Deborah says, a darn good movie. And Lisa says, Mary Poppins is a movie I can always watch. Another is The Sandlot. There are many subtle lessons in each for both children and adults. Yeah, when my kids were little, I had a lot that I liked to watch with them. One show I might go back and watch on my own time is this one, Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends. Just one of the weirdest animated things. Kid appropriate, but kind of cool for grown-ups too. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Live from NPR News, I'm Jack Spear. President Biden says the world and the U.S. cannot wait any longer in terms of tackling climate change. Biden announcing today he's taking a